So we're doing mind weeds today. I suggested to people this morning that they read Mind Waves also, because he keeps referring to mind waves when he's talking about mind weeds, but it doesn't make that much difference. So Kelly, can you talk about why you chose this one?
Sure. After I tried to steal everybody else's fascicle first and was a miserable failure at it, I dove back in. And finding this one, I looked at it, and like all of these fascicles, it was exactly the opposite of what I expected it to be. I was like, mind weeds. Yeah, I got those. How do I get those out of there? And that's not at all what the fascicle is. But the thing that really grabbed me about it, well, there's a line where he says, "We say pulling out the weeds, we give nourishment to the plant. We pull the weeds and bury them near the plant to give it nourishment," which is the exact opposite of everything I know about weeds. And like, there's so many things that my brain goes, no, you don't pull the weeds and just leave them there, and you don't bury them because they're weeds and they're not good for the plants. But then that got me thinking about a book that I read last year, and this is really why I got grabbed onto it. And it was the, some of you may have read this, The One Straw Revolution. No, okay. It's Masanobu Fukuoka. And he was a Japanese, originally like farm scientist. He was like was an entomologist. And he got seriously ill at some point, went into the hospital, and in the hospital, he had this real epiphany. And this is what he wrote about the epiphany. I copied this down. His epiphany was, "In this world, there is nothing at all. I felt that I understood nothing." That was his deeply positive epiphany. And what he did after that was go and open up a farm to prove that everything he had studied and done before was wrong. And one of the main things was letting things grow wild and letting the land use the things that grew in them in the way that the land wanted to use the things that grew in them. And he talks a lot about weeds and how weeds are fabulously useful, and that, you know, if you're not desperately trying to plot out your farm and desperately trying to like draw rigid lines and do sort of monoculture things, that the weeds actually end up being quite beneficial. And so that's the thing. And like much of this book, like I'm always trying to envelop and be enveloped by what's being said. And in this case, I'm still struggling for that. Struggling's not the word, maybe a little. But it's this concept of, if I try and grasp on to my orderliness, I'm going to be frustrated. All it's going to be is a constant slog. And if I allow into it some of the wildness, then things will grow. Things will grow without me forcing them to grow. And those concepts that really drew me in, because I feel like in a lot of ways, this idea of letting things grow as opposed to trying to make them grow is a bit of what I get out of mind weeds. So those are my thoughts about that.
So that was useful.
Yeah. Can I say something?
Yeah, sure.
I forgot who said this. It might have been Robert Rodale or somebody like that, who said that a weed is a plant out of place. And when you think of them that way, it's just, we make them a weed.
Yeah.
They're not inherently a weed.
I also heard someone say, like a year or so ago, it's like, if your garden is too wild, that's your problem. It's not the gardens.
Well, I want to get into that whole notion and how we deal with weeds, because nowadays I think they often think of them as cover crops and then they use them, but I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. Steve, did you have anything you wanted to say about this before you go?
I didn't have anything in particular, but I thought that was very thought-provoking, Kelly. It's I wouldn't have taken it that whole direction, probably because I don't tend to read about agriculture at all. That was very fascinating, and I do definitely see parallels in that. I'm kind of a control freak with my own mind, or I guess I shouldn't say am, because I'm working on it and I'm not so much, but the more I try to control what's going on and have little orderly thoughts and have the thoughts not morph into each other and get and stay out of their rows, the more I don't do that, actually the better I feel, which is the opposite of what I used to think, but I had to try it, and yeah, so appreciate that.
Thank you.
Appreciate you bringing that up. So I'm going to get going now. Thank you.
Have fun.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Jackie's going to work on finance stuff about the house.
Yep.
He's not going to have
Oh, yeah, Zach, you weren't here when I said that. Yeah. Reams of paperwork.
Snarky remark on my part.
Yep.
Okay, so there are a few things I want to say, and then I want to open it up. I want to read the first paragraph, full paragraph of Mind Waves, gives you just a little sense of what he's talking about there. He says, when you're practicing Zazen, do not try to stop your thinking. Let it stop by itself. If something comes into your mind, let it come in and let it go out. It will not stay long. When you try to stop your thinking, it means you're bothered by it. Do not be bothered by it. Do but not be bothered by anything. It appears as if something comes from outside your mind, but actually it is only the waves of your mind. And if you are not bothered by the waves, gradually they will become calmer and calmer. In 5 or at most 10 minutes, your mind will be completely serene and calm. At that time, your breathing will become quite slow while your pulse will become a little faster. That's true, but I don't know about the 5 or 10 minutes. Your mind will be completely serene and calm.
That's ambitious.
Yeah. this is my experience, and what I think is that there is a calmness that comes, even though your mind may still be going and whatever, but after, usually, not always, but after 5 or 10 minutes, I think usually there is more of a sense of calm and less of a sense maybe of being bothered by the mind waves. And you kind of settle into it. And you get calmer without even knowing. What it reminded me of was my experience of one-day sittings and sesshins. And that sometimes my mind has been really, really busy and it's been hard to settle down. And that's gone on for a long time. And then I noticed one time years ago, I'd had a sesshin like that that was just a real drag. And then I went on a walk. This was a green gulch. I went on a walk up the hill and I sat down on a bench that was available to sit down and look out over the ocean. And then I noticed that I was calm, you know, even after all this mishigas, when I just sat down and I didn't need to read something. I didn't need to open my bag lunch that I had. I didn't need to do anything. I just sat there and it felt really good. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, something happened, even though I was not aware of it. And it didn't seem like it happened during the sesshin, but it did. And I'm aware of that now a lot, you know, often in the, you know, the evening we end around, you know, 9:15, and I don't go right to bed, but I notice that I'm just calmer no matter what's gone on during the day. So something happens. But I just wanted that sense, and we can quibble with him about the 5 or at most 10. Well, you know, your mind will be completely calm and serene. I think that's probably along the lines of, this is the most important thing. You know, so to not get caught with his hyperbole, or feel get caught. That's a mind weed. And I really do. I love that idea that when he talks about weeds to nourish plants. I mean, and I think about that. I know that, you know, in organic farming, a lot of the time they grow. What do they grow? Like mustard. And I think nasturtiums do. There are various plants that are usually thought of as weeds, but that actually nourish the soil, and so they are allowed to just grow, and then they're plowed under. And which is seems to me pretty much the same as his saying, bury them near the plants. And one way of thinking about that is that the mind weeds are compost. No. And I suppose there are weeds that are bad or toxic. And okay, but mostly I think not. And we just, what was it? Somebody said, you know, that it's just in the wrong place. Or I just have an idea about it. I mean, there are probably people that don't like nasturtiums. I don't understand that. But
yeah, you know, tomato plants are toxic. But we just decide they're okay.
You mean the leaves are toxic?
Yeah, they are.
That's why they're nightshades, right?
Yeah. However, in small doses, they're really great in a sauce.
And he says to be grateful for them because they enrich our practice. And I think they do. Because I want to say 4 things at once. Allowing the mind to just be itself and allowing the thoughts to come and go, just that practice itself of not grasping onto them and not pushing them away, is tremendously useful. And it's literally a practice of acceptance, right? A practice of letting go. And you have to have something to let go of in order to do that practice. So I keep thinking about that, you know, the Tibetans saying that an enemy is like a great jewel because they teach you so much. But also I think mind weeds are, I mean, the way I think of them, I don't know exactly what he meant by them, but I think that those ones that are, you know, thoughts that arise that are really difficult when we're obsessing or when we're angry or hurt or whatever, and that really trouble us and that we have a hard time letting go of. That process is useful in itself, right? If the letting go needs to involve being willing to sit still for difficult physical experiences of those emotions, and you do it and you feel like the fear of death, say, and you survive, then in that process you learn that you can survive that you can allow yourself to be completely yourself. And it's okay. And that is our practice. So I think that assuming that is included, at least included, those kinds of difficulties are included in mind weeds, that process of letting them come and go, but being willing to stay with them, that's tremendously important and encouraging. And to when you begin to allow that to happen and turn towards them and stay with them, it definitely enriches your practice. So I wanted to read the first full paragraph on page 26. I have this sort of small version of the book, kind of hardbound, so I assume it's the same, but you don't need to look at it really. Okay, he says, strictly speaking, any effort we make is not good. He backs up. If you have some experience of how the weeds in your mind change into mental nourishment, your practice will make remarkable progress. You will feel the progress.
I'm still waiting for that to happen.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's what I was just talking about, but I don't know what he means by it. Okay, strictly speaking, any effort we make is not good for our practice because it creates waves in our mind. It is impossible, however, to attain absolute calmness of our mind without any effort. We must make some effort, but we must forget ourselves in the effort we make. In this realm, there is no subjectivity or objectivity. Our mind is just calm without even any awareness. In this unawareness, every effort and every idea and thought will vanish. So it is necessary for us to encourage ourselves and to make an effort up to the last moment when all effort disappears. You should keep your mind on your breathing until you are not aware of your breathing. I think that's true, but he makes it seem a little easier than it is. But when you sit retreats and so on, when you sit longer, you can have that experience. And it may well come and go, especially if it's, say, you sat a 5-day sesshin, you know, you'd have times when there was this calmness. We did that thing with breathing. I think Steve, during a lecture on Saturday, had us stop and just notice our breathing. And people talked about this. He asked if time were there, and the consensus seemed to be not so much or not in any usual way, that it was just breath. So there is that experience of settling and just presence, and not I'm breathing or I'm present. And we do have to make an effort to get to that. You have to make the effort to sit up straight. You have to make the effort to follow your breath. You have to make the effort to let go of discursive thinking over and over. You have to make the effort to sit still for difficult things and then allow them to arise, abide, and pass away. And then on the other side of that, there can be calmness. So it's necessary for us to encourage ourselves and make an effort up to the last moment. And I think I just would say it a little different. What I tend to say is that you make an effort, but it's not an effort to anything. It's just an effort to sit up straight, to let go, to pay attention, you know, but it's not an effort to get something or somewhere. So it's an effort to, part of that effort is letting go. And then sometimes, from time to time, you do let go, and there's just this sitting there, and there's not a sense of effort anymore. You know, and then something happens. You have to go back to making an effort. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Do you have anything to say about this?
Where I got caught up early on, and I can still do this from time to time, but I don't do it so much as I would read the like in 5 or most 10 minutes and think, oh, well, I must be doing something wrong because I'm definitely not calm in 5 to 10 minutes when I sit down. And so I thank you for saying, you know, it might not be 5 or 10 minutes. Sometimes it's not for the whole period, you know.
The next, I don't want to get ahead of us, but, you know, the next period, the next paragraph says, we should try to continue our effort forever, but we should not expect to reach some stage where we will forget all about it. And,
well, and then right after he says the 5 or 10 minutes things, the next paragraph, he says it will take quite a long time before you find your calm, serene mind. So it's like, oh, well, thanks. Good. Good. That's reassuring. But I will say that it does happen. It has happened for me, and it happens more consistently the more I sit. Huh, surprise, surprise.
Anybody else? Just go ahead and speak. You don't have to be called on because there are not that many of us here.
You know, it's difficult sometimes for me to understand. So, like, you know, doing my sitting and having those moments where, you know, the breath has sort of disappeared, and like, you know, my body is, it's staying upright with no effort. These are. You know, I feel like these are proper things to happen. But it's sometimes very difficult for me to delineate between that and my mind is just somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And they're very similar sensations, I think, in some ways. Or maybe I'm just always my mind is somewhere else and I've never had the other one.
I think I can understand that. I'm going to say I can understand that misunderstanding. I don't know that you do misunderstand it, but you know, there are similarities and they're entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell the difference. It just that when you're, you know, when you're sort of dozing off or your mind is somewhere else, you're not noticing. You know, and other times when you are present, there's not thinking about it or anything, but there is still some sort of awareness that you're present, even though you're not commenting on it.
It's subtle though in a lot of ways. Yeah.
That's the word that I was gonna say. I think the more you sit, the more subtle things are, there's more subtle discrimination, or if that makes sense. I can think of, like, with a painting or with the practice of painting, the more you look, the more you see. You know, so I mean, I used to look at something and only see maybe three values to any given color. And the more you look, the more you see there are 12 variations, you know, and is that kind of like that?
Yeah.
you know, when you're timekeeper or doan, and you have your eye on the clock periodically, it seems like the zazen takes longer. Then when you hand the clock to someone else and sit without it, and the bell rings and you go, wow, that was fast. Because I think you're not... A, you're not trying to remember to ring the bell on at the right time, but you're not, I guess you could say you're not thinking about time. You're not thinking about thinking. And it's a treat. If you've been the timekeeper and then you're not, it's like a gift. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how that fits in, but I bet a number of you have had that experience before.
The time can be a mind weed.
Yes.
And it's a gift that you make when you are timekeeper. It's a gift that you make to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. But you know, it's a really nice metaphor, the time being a weed, because the more we fight it, the more we say, oh, we're not aging, which I've been doing a lot of in the past couple of weeks, and we're not you know, and things are not changing as our lives move forward, the more we fight that, the more miserable we are. But if we let all of those things through time kind of fall into the soil of our lives and nurture it, it can be really wonderful. Have I overextended the metaphor?
No. It's really beautiful, Kelly. Thank you for saying that, and Zach for saying that. And I had an impression, brief impression, that maybe you had touched on the idea of not suffering through the way you were both explaining that, and maybe that was a little bit of the practice and maybe a little bit of what it's about. And by being wholehearted in our practice, we can touch it a little bit. Yeah. And yeah. Grow that even in the middle of a lot of tough shit, you know.
Yeah. I think that's right. And shit is manure.
It's very good for your crops.
It is. I wish I had good stuff for my garden, as a matter of fact.
Well, it's, you know, when you're making compost, that's one of the things you add, at least at Tassajara, well rotted horse manure.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that Those are some mind weeds. I have some that are well rotted. Akta, please feel invited but not required to speak.
Well, in my sitting today, in my practice today, I think I experienced a mind weed in a form of the feeling of fear. And so I tend to learn from the feelings as much as I would a thought, or maybe more. But the fear kind of lives in my belly, or it was in the practice today, in my belly and in my body. And previously I have felt almost wrong and shameful to have that feeling when I should be meditating and everything, you know, the shoulds. But today I felt it, and I felt a very tender, gentle compassion towards myself for having it. And that's how I'm kind of sitting with this, with the mind weed thing, that we should rather be grateful for the weeds, you know, for, in my experience, the fear that I was experiencing, that I was feeling, because eventually it will enrich your practice, and how beautiful it is to meet that, you know, with compassion, you know, just pure compassion. So yeah. That was my experience today.
Good. Well, that sounds wonderful. And drop the shoulds. I have a sign that says, take a kindly, friendly interest. Not a... Ouch. Yeah. Yeah. They're there. That's part of being human. So just be human. And it's also true that the more that you know it in yourself and accept it and live it, you know, it's hard stuff, the more useful you can be to other people. One time years ago, before the new baths at Tassajara, so this would have been before 93, I was walking by there's a bridge that goes across the creek to where the old baths were. And there was a plunge in those old baths, as there is in the new. Anyway, I remember I was walking by, minding my own business. and as I was walking by, I suddenly had this very, it was totally physical, this deep urge to go drown myself in that plunge. And it just came out of nowhere. I hadn't been thinking about anything. I wasn't depressed, or I don't know where it came from. It was really, it was very strong. It was momentary. I kept walking. I didn't stop. And it was very frightening. It was terrifying. And one of the reasons I appreciate having had the experience is that I have, I think, at least a little bit of a feeling, some idea of what people talk about when they say they have suicidal thoughts. And I've often since said, is that scary? You know, and I know it is, but I try not to tell people what they feel, but I'm just saying that because I've had that experience, I feel like I know something about the human condition. And we all have these, whatever experience it is, and then you know something about the human condition. And if you don't pull away from it, it can enrich your practice.
Is that why he says in Mind Ways, whatever your experience is an expression of big mind? So it's like the human condition.
Yes. Yes, but I wouldn't, I'm saying it in a more nitty gritty way.
Yeah.
He says the paragraph above what I read, we must have the actual experience of how our weeds change into nourishment. And that's what I was just talking about. Mm-hmm. I think that weed changed into nourishment. And Asha's weed today changed into nourishment. Okay, I want to read the last paragraph. Somebody else want to read it? We should try to continue our effort. Anybody have a book handy?
I have it.
Go for it.
We should try to continue our effort forever, but we should not expect to reach some stage when we will forget all about it. We should just try to keep our mind on our breathing. That is our actual practice. That effort will be refined more and more while you are sitting. At first, the effort you make is quite rough and impure, but by the power of practice, the effort will become purer and purer. When your effort becomes pure, your body and mind become pure. This is the way we practice then. Once you understand our innate power to purify ourselves and our surroundings, you can act properly, and you will learn from those around you, and you will become friendly with others. This is the merit of Zen practice. But the way of practice is just to be concentrated on your breathing with the right posture and with great pure effort. This is how we practice Zen.
Yep. I love that. Once you understand our innate power to purify ourselves and our surroundings, you can act properly and you will learn from those around you and you'll become friendly with others.
Yeah. I feel friendly with all of you guys.
Well, with you, it's easy. Mostly. It's when I go out there.
Yeah, it's really true.
Is it appropriate to say as it is in my mind instead of pure?
Yes and no. I think it's useful if there's a word that triggers us, it's useful to get to know it.
Okay.
Rather than substitute something. But I think we talked about this before, and I don't remember if it was in my opening lecture or yeah. or last week, but that you know, that he talks about there's a word pure, but it isn't about being chaste and not drinking and I don't know what all. It's what Kate was talking about thing it getting more subtle. Because and that's why it's not so rough. Because you're trying too hard or you're grasping after this or you're beating yourself up. All those kinds of things. So can you just do it? And and with great pure effort. And it is great effort. Sometimes it's easy, but a lot of times it's an effort, you know, to sit up straight and to come back to your breath and to let go of delicious thoughts. And delicious can be because they're full of hatred and anger and snark, or because they're about somebody you're attracted to or dinner. So Dana, it's an aspirational word. You know, it's in the same category maybe as, you know, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. You know, what the hell does that mean?
I guess yeah, that is what I would like to sit with.
What did you say, Dana?
I guess when you said that earlier, I guess I was surprised how much that word is so sticky for me because of maybe years of conditioning raising in evangelical land.
In Catholic land.
Catholic land, yeah. Yeah, pure. So thank you for reminding me of that.
Well, it's a word where I have trouble with it also, but I've sat with it a lot. I mean, I haven't struggled with it particularly. There are other things that I guess I did, but yeah. But it's always sort of, it triggered me a little.
Mm.
Anybody have anything you want to say about purity or continuing your effort forever?
Let's all continue our effort forever.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's do.
Do you understand? Once you understand your innate power to purify yourself and your surroundings, what does that mean to you?
I think I might be wrong. I perceive it as coming back to the breath, coming back to now, coming back to not pushing it all away. That seems innate.
I think so, and that you have that power. In other words, your practice can make a tremendous difference. Any other thoughts?
You know, the tricky thing for me is like to say that that I have power to do something. My head automatically interprets it as effort. You know, it's like, yes, I can punch through, right? And I know that's not the case, but that is my immediate inclination. Is like, if I just put all my weight against it, I'll be pure. Okay. And it just don't work that way.
Yeah, well, and he talks, but there is an effort, but it's not that effort.
Yeah, the effort is elusive.
I don't know. It doesn't feel elusive to me. I feel very conscious of it a lot of the time.
Well, that's why you're the boss.
Oh.
What were you going to say, Asha?
Oh, there's a poem that kind of reminds me of what we're talking about that I keep thinking about. I'm not going to be able to recite it, but it's by Martha Postlewaite. And in it, she says something like, you know, do not try to do anything grandiose or, you know, massive, but create a clearing in the dense forest of your life so you can wait there, like with your own cupped hands, so that the song that is your life comes into your own cupped hands, something like that. But it's beautiful, but it reminds me of our topic.
Yeah, that is beautiful. And I mean, we talk sometimes about, you know, sitting down by a forest pool. And if you sit quietly, then all of the little animals from the forest will come and do their thing and be visible to you. Whereas if you go tromping around looking for them, you'll never see them.
I like how Suzuki Roshi has all these comments and we're trying to figure out what he means. And then he brings it back to just solid. But the way to practice is just to be concentrated on your breath with the right posture and with great pure effort. He just, you know, gives us practical advice at the end.
Sit down, get
it's simple.
That's right.
I will have to say too, when I'm in the Zendo, and there's a lecture, I really love the expression of his face on the wall.
That's a great picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love, he looks like he's amused and pleased. And I don't like to even put words on it because it labels it for everyone else. And he also looks like my brother. A little bit.
Well, there's a thing that people do. You put a card or put your hand even on one side of his face in that photograph, and then on the other, and one eye looks amused and the other eye doesn't.
Yeah.
the frame that's in that picture, Mel gave it to me, And a man named Darian Rezizad, I guess it is, he's Persian, gave it to Mel. And I just heard from Darian. He sent out a general email to a bunch of people about Mel's lectures. But I recognize the name, and I think I know him, but I know we overlapped at Tassajara, but I think I know him a little better. I think he was also at City Center. Anyway, I told him that I had ended up with the frame that Mel had given it to. He actually gave it to us, to the temple. It was a Zendo opening gift. And anyway, I told Darian that, and he said, I said, I wondered if it were an antique. And he said, he went back to Iran to take care of his parents. So that's where he is. And he said, here, it wouldn't be an antique because things go back thousands of years. It's only about 100 years old. But they don't make things like, you know, that way anymore. But it was kind of, I don't know. Anyway, take a look at it sometime. It's mosaic.
I will.
And mosaic.
I'll be a look at that.
Yeah. And I got the frame from Mel's. Just, I thought it would go nicely. But guys, there was no way that we were going to like match that frame. So anyway. So maybe we're done. Are we done? Is there any final thoughts? I don't want to start another one. But does anybody have anything else you want to say? Okay, so next class is Meryl, I believe.
Meryl, right? And then. Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is a bowing. Yeah. Okay. So, you ready? We just do this one time. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are...